This is a kind of a paradigm shift that can flip a lot of people on their head. And I've been teaching this method of reading astrology now going on about 16, 17 years. I guess I first introduced it in astrology class in Manchester, England in 1998 and taught it to a group of astrologers there. And I've had all kinds of reactions to this, including everything from my clients won't stand for this. I have to tell them exactly what the good dates to do things are to start their business or to, you know, file their paperwork for this court case or whatever, to feeling like they're not really being an astrologer if they spend an hour sitting with a person and figuring out what it is that this person needs. And so the thing that I do with all new clients and often with returning clients is always is figure out what brings the person there. And so if someone's coming to you for professional work, then it's very important for you to find out what they want and what they need and to get as specific as you can. You know, sometimes people say, well, I want to know about love and I want to know about money and I want to know about work. It's like, okay, thanks for the information. Then you start to have to boil that down and bring them out a little bit. And this is partly what we're going to learn how to do in this discussion. But if I leave you with nothing else, if you hang up, if you close your browser or hang up the phone 60 seconds from now, this is the most significant thing to take out of this program, is that initially you have to find out what's going on with the person who's sitting in front of you. And as you'll see when we do the chart demonstration, find out how their chart works. It's not up to you to just look at the chart and assume you know how that chart works. If you scan down the two charts of our classmates here, April and Karen, they both happen to be people who have charts with major concentrations of planets in one quadrant of the chart. You don't have any idea how that works. I don't have any idea how that works. And I've been looking at these charts for nearly half my life, and we have to find out what that's about. There are, you know, those moments when you're going to need to look at a chart and say something, but I prefer to keep that part under 5 minutes if I'm going to do that. I've read one of the ways I've done this is every one of the models I photograph, well, not everyone, but many of the models I photograph for Book of Blue, I look at their chart and I give them a five-minute reading where I tell them things. But I don't want to go more than 5 minutes without really having a lot of context of where this person is coming from. And I will just leave it at that. And I trust I'll be able to demonstrate why that's so meaningful. The cautionary part of this that I would say that I've learned to bring into any of my classes on the centaurs, of which this is going to be one when we start looking at Chiron, is that in opening up to what's going on with someone and inviting someone who you may or may not be familiar with to open up to you, you may find yourself going into deep water with a person. And you need to know the very basics of how to handle that, of how to not take on their material, of how to be with people through challenging things that come up. I mean, you, for example, need to be comfortable with someone just starting to cry in the middle of a session and knowing you don't really need to do anything except just be patient and empathetic and just hang out with them till their emotional state comes back to center and they're able to converse again. We live in a world where people spend most of their lives bottling things up. Everyone does this. There's various rumors that one sex or gender or the other is more open and better. And to some extent, there's a half a truth to that. But the reality is people keep their secrets. And their secrets tend to torture them, and their secrets tend to start to define who they are and calcify and turn into these layers of armor. And what you're doing in sitting with a person with their astrology open, where you've got this very powerful way to see and understand and get some idea of who a person is through using the chart and an approach to the chart, you're subverting that whole thing about keeping secrets, that whole trip that our society is on, that we can't really be known for who we are, and everything about us is scandalous, and we've all got skeletons in the closet and all of this stuff, and there's hardly anyone who has a truly clear conscience. And even if they have no reason not to have a clear conscience, the feeling of not having one can be aggravated by the mere fact of keeping secrets. And so as you make these polite, gentle inquiries into people's experience, and you listen to what they're saying, and you observe how their experience aligns with their chart, you can learn a lot very quickly. In the space of 1 hour, you can learn more about someone than they may have told their most intimate friend, because you're able to see patterns. And after a little while of combining the chart with the transits, with the experience of the transits, the thing pops into a kind of three-dimensional reality. When I do this class in person, though it doesn't work so well and I need to figure out an easier way to demonstrate the same thing, I've hung up posters of from the Magic Eye book series. They're these things that look like they look like kind of random geometric patterns on a page, and then if you look at the page or the postcard or the book and you are able to focus behind the plane of the image, another image comes out, like kangaroos or a locomotive or a panda bear and her baby, something like this. And that's kind of how the chart works. And so one thing this does is it takes pressure off of you that at the first glance you don't have to be able to say this is what this chart means. And hopefully that doesn't kill the whole mystique of astrology for you, but I think you'll see as you do this for a while and you're able to go deeper into this experience and get some experience working with people, you'll see that this is very helpful, and that without even saying much of anything, only by sitting with people and listening to the stories of their transits, you are serving as a facilitator of healing, because you are helping people bring out parts of themselves that may have been compartmentalized or stuffed inside, and to see some patterns in their lives that they may not have been able to see. And you don't need to predict or judge or size that up in any way. Just hold space and be warm. And then what to do often becomes very obvious, what to say and what to do. Personally, I like to take the case in one session, listen to the person's experiences, run through about 7 of their past transits in a way I'm going to demonstrate in a little while, and let that brew, let that just simmer for a week or two, and then come back and look at the chart for a second time. And so whether you're doing this professionally, you're doing it for friends and colleagues or relatives, I suggest that you work in more than one meeting, and that you put some space in between the meetings, at least a few days, so the person's unconscious has time to work on contemplating, experiencing what they've said, and then come back to the chart and then just start over again. And what you'll see is that you're going to hear things from the person based on certain timing factors in the chart that you would never have read into the chart had you not taken a moment to ask them. Now, I'm saying all of this assuming that everyone knows what a transit is and how to find a transit in the ephemeris. And so if you don't know how to do that, what you're going to need to do is just listen to this class and then piece together what you can about how to find a transit, and then re-listen to it, and it will start to make more sense. I'm also going to suggest that we create a mailing list of the people in the class, and that that you buddy up, pick one or two people, and run through the process of listening to people's transit stories with one another first, so that everyone here gets the experience of being on both sides of the transit experience. What we're doing here is a method, like almost anything, that depends on having a feel for the work and for how it's done. And there's only one way to get that feel for things, which is to keep practicing and to keep finding subjects to work with, and doing this over and over again till the whole thing becomes second nature. In the beginning, it used to take me an hour and a half to go through the chart in the first session, and I would check every single transit that I could. I mean, there's obviously a lot of transits, but working with outer planets, Chiron, Saturn, check numerous, sometimes 20 transits in the first session. Now, if I need to, I can focus it down to maybe three events that tell me what I need to know about how a person experiences their astrology. And, of course, the first person to do this with is yourself, is to journal out your own transits, including major transits of Chiron, Chiron square, Chiron opposition, Chiron conjunct the sun, and then also Saturn return, first Saturn return, Uranian opposition, Pluto square, Neptune square, second Chiron square, Chiron return, and so forth. And you'll see a progression of events in your own life. And as you see this, you'll start to understand that transits have meaning, and that the idea of doing a reading for someone is stepping in to the moment of their current transits, which is in the context of all their past transits. And I'm not suggesting here that the past is a predictor of the future as much as to say that past transits can give you a sense of how the person involved responds when the energy is cranked up in their chart, when the energy is juiced up, and there's, you know, in the case of, like, for example, if you glance at Karen's chart, well, what happened when during her Saturn return when she was about 29 or 30 years old, right? That's an important thing to know. And somehow I think astrology, I haven't only once heard an astrologer say in a class that if the person has booked you for a one-hour session and it takes you 55 minutes of that 1 hour to figure out why they're there, take the 55 minutes and then talk to them for 5 minutes. That is far better than grasping and giving them a recitation of their squares and their trines. The critique I hear the most of astrology readings is this person was very smart and they said all the stuff, but I didn't understand a damn thing that it was, which is laughable because the person is coming to the astrologer for understanding. The person is coming for the purpose of learning something. And with that said, I don't think it really matters how they learn things, whether they learn them from them talking or from you talking, as long as they learn them. But you're more likely to get valid information about the chart and about the client from the client. And your job as the astrologer is to assemble those two pieces, the information coming from the client and the information coming from the chart. And that synthesis, which can take time, is what I would call a reading. Now, after a while, you may just be able to spot things in a chart, but it still can be risky saying things that are not necessarily true. So I would encourage you to avoid doing that and to get your validation from the person involved. Now, I realize this is a deeper reading than, you know, looking at a chart and saying, you know, the first chart I've put up on the materials thing is Babe Ruth. And you could look at the chart and say, oh, you know, he had the moon in Cancer rising and he had Cancer rising. Oh, look, the Aries point is rising. He's going to be famous. forever, basically. Wow, the Aries point, oh, he's got the moon rising. He resonates with the public. Okay. Oh, the trans-Pluto, he resonates with the public for something very specific, baseball. All of that is interesting, but it doesn't necessarily help someone that much. If you look at someone's chart and say, oh, look at that. Oh, they have that. Oh, that's nice. So the branch of astrology that we're really learning here today is more about counseling than it is just about basic personality traits. And there can be some value. I mean, it's certainly fun to have, basic personality traits. I mean, I have Venus and Taurus, and one day I looked that up in Secrets from a Stargazer's Notebook by Debbie Kempton Smith, and Debbie Kempton Smith said, oh, Venus and Taurus, these people like to go to the same restaurant every day and eat the same thing. Now, 15 years later, I'm still laughing because that's exactly what I do. I go to the same restaurant every day and eat the same thing. Now, that's funny, but it's not necessarily going to be a satisfying experience of understanding. But to get to that point of the experience, you need to be taking the risk of being open to someone, and they need to be taking the risk of opening up, and then there can be a real exchange and some real bonding with you and the client and the client and their chart. And after a while, this is going to seem very natural because, after all, you wouldn't want to go to a naturopathic doctor or nutritionist, and they don't even ask what you like to eat, right? Imagine you go, you need some nutritional counseling. You go to a nutritionist, and they don't bother to ask you what you eat. You might think, well, how are you going to help me then? So you're not a clairvoyant. And you're not supposed to be a clairvoyant. And one of the most problematic things in the image of astrology in our culture is that we're expected to be predictors. We're expected to say what's going to happen. People are scared of us because we're going to say, oh, you're going to die in, November of 2092. And this makes astrology scary, and it gives people an incorrect impression of astrology. All right, so that's my little rant on what we're doing and why we're doing it. I'd like to walk you through, why don't we pause for a couple of questions. Any thoughts about that, or is that clear enough? Let me glance in the Q&A and I'm going to refresh this page. I think that's the rule, right? File can't be found. Oh, that's terrible. Have I been logged out? Oh, no. Okay. I'm having a little technical issue here. Oh, no. It's forgotten my... Okay. So I've been logged out. I'm going to have to pause for a second and quit my browser and start that up again. So I need to indulge you for half a second. Firefox was blocking me out of the New York Times last night also. So let's see. Let's see if I can get Chelsea's attention because I don't know the. I have the login information saved, so let's excuse Firefox from this task, and Safari.
Okay. Phone control.
We're still a little bit new at this. Okay. So now we're back, and let's see if I can go into the Q&A panel, see all questions. All right, so in terms of specific questions, I'm not going to handle those yet. Any specific questions about the concept of how I'm suggesting that we be leading and the approach to working with the client as one of using astrology to help you learn about the client and their life in the first instance and taking as long as you need to take to do that, and then as you really have something to say to give feedback about their experience and about their chart. Okay, so I'm not seeing any there. So let's, Chelsea, would you please put the, let's see here, maybe I can give Firefox that job because it's not requiring a login. I'd like to take a second and go over the materials I've given you in the natal chart class. There are some very basic tools of the trade that you need to have in order to be able to be set up to do this. One of them is you need to be able to cast charts. And I suggest that you invest in a proper chart casting program on your computer and not go through astro.com. You need to have your files on hand. I'm never comfortable using a third-party thing where things are stored in their database and I don't actually have them locally. And besides which, this is a professional endeavor for most of you where you will be making money doing this, and certainly even if you don't set out to do it, it is not going to take more than a year or two of sincere effort and study till you're able to actually work with people. And I suggest you make an investment first and foremost in astrology software for your computer. There's some that are pretty good, and they're as little as $100. I can share some of those programs with you, and the better ones go for anywhere from $300 to $500, but you can get set up for relatively little. The next most important tool is that you have an ephemeris as a book. I know there's all kinds of online ephemerides, but they you can't really browse them. You can't really find the transits in the way that you need to find them, and part of the way you need to find the transits is to be able to look through, to scan through the months and years of time more quickly than a computer can move, and also be able to have the overview. Now, there's a problem with printed ephemeris tools right now, because really the only good ephemeris printed in the United States is splitting the 20th and 21st centuries into two different books. We've all pleaded with the publisher to get her to do one that goes, say, for example, from 1930 to 2030, but to no avail. And so on the materials for natal chart class, I've got two listed, New American for the 20th and New American for the 21st. Any adult you're reading for now is going to have transits that you're going to be looking at that happened way back in the 20th century. And so you need to know what they are. The best ephemeris that's currently in print is from France. It's very hard to get, but I suggest it's worth the effort. It's a bit expensive. It's about $60. It's called the Aureas, A-U-R-E-A-S, ephemeris. And this is one that includes some minor points. It's very nicely done. And these books go from, like, for example, 1920 to 2020 or 1930 to 2030. And that's the time range that you need to be using, because you're going to read for people who are born in 1935, 1950, and you're going to be looking at transits going all the way back. For Chiron transits per se, there is a The third item on the webpage, the Chiron Monthly Ephemeris printable, that is a tool that was designed specifically for this type of class by Tracy Delaney, and this is a way to scan through Chiron transits very quickly. And again, in a little while, in about half an hour, we're going to learn how to do that. There's another tool that I will put up here, which is, enables you to look up any planets for make an ephemeris for any duration of time. It might be a suitable, substitute if you don't have a paper ephemeris. It certainly looks more like a paper ephemeris, but there's no substitute for a paper ephemeris, again, to find something like the position of Venus on one particular day in 1968. Okay, there's a resource that I've arranged with Rob Hand to make available to you, and that is the book Whole Sign Houses by Rob Hand. I am not a strict advocate of whole sign houses, but I think we all have to know the history of how the astrology chart came to be what it is. And if you read Whole Sign Houses by Rob Hand, which is a short, kind of dense, but very smart, nicely written little book, that everyone in this class has the ability to download. We are paying Rob royalties for each person in the class, so please don't pass it out or put it on the internet. We've actually bought you a copy that you can download and take a look at this thing, and you will get the feeling for the history of astrology. I think that it's essential for anyone doing astrology in modern times to have a sense of where the profession has come from, where this art has been in the past couple of thousand years. And so I've got three tools for you to do that, one of which is Whole Sign Houses by Rob Hand. This, by the way, became his dissertation, which clocked in at about 700 pages, including like 150 pages of footnotes, and he just got his PhD earlier this year at something like age 73. Got it from American Catholic University, somewhat humorously. Okay, the other essential tool to have is, it's the second graphic down, and it's called the Table of Essential Dignities of the Planets According to Ptolemy. And I know it looks more complex than it is, but if you study this thing for a couple of days or, you know, even a few hours or a few years, which is really, you know, it'll keep you busy your whole life, I consider this to be the most important book about astrology, and it fits on an index card. It is a table that explains all of the different types of traditional rulership using only planets from Moon and Sun out to Saturn. So personally, I don't worry about rulerships of anything discovered by science. Rulership is a term that, in my opinion, applies to the traditional planets. I will occasionally make reference to Pluto as a modern ruler of Scorpio or Neptune as a modern ruler of Pisces, but I try to minimize that. And if you like the concept of rulership, look at how this thing works. It would be worth a whole class on how to use this, and in a more advanced class I'll do that. But take a look at this thing. The words D, the letters D and N are just day and night. So looking across the first line, you can see that the sign Aries is ruled by Mars, houses of the planets, that lists Mars, is the day ruler. So Mars is associated with Aries during the day. The sun is exalted. The triplicity is water. The day ruler of that, fire, the fire group is the sun. The night ruler is Jupiter, and so on. Print a couple of copies of this thing. Stick them as bookmarks in your astrology notebooks and in your textbooks. Carry the thing around. Reference it. Look at it. Study it. You will eventually figure out what is going on. If you can get yourself a copy of the monograph by Rob Hand called Night and Day, it will tell you about all this nighttime and daytime business. I don't personally follow this strictly, but I think it's well worth knowing that it exists so that you at least have one toe in the water of traditional astrology. I know there is a kind of a somewhat reactionary movement of people, particularly young astrologers, to make Hellenistic astrology be the only valid astrology. And it's kind of funny how they've in some ways taken over the consciousness of new astrology, and they do whole sign houses at the point of a gun and things like this. And I don't think it's necessary to go that far, but if you're at a conference, it's definitely worth taking one or two of the classes on Hellenistic just to get a sense of the mentality, just to get a sense of some of the techniques. But most of the important techniques you will see in the Table of Essential Dignities, according to Ptolemy, and above that, a very simple rendition of that, which is the Thema Mundi, the oldest known astrological document in Western astrology. And again, I don't have time to teach a whole class on this, but I can hand you this document, as I've just done, and just let you know that it exists. The most interesting thing about the Thema Mundi, if you will notice, is that in the ascendant is the sign Cancer. The ancient, whoever, Atlanteans or whoever, Egyptians or Greeks or whoever the heck they were that took this up, the Babylonians, a whole bunch of people passed this thing around, probably is Babylonian. It may have been an agricultural tool as much as a divination tool, but they put the sign Cancer in the east, not Aries. And I think this is a really important thing. I call it the 90-degree shift, because we are so obsessed with the concept of the first house equals Aries and the second house equals Taurus, but this is saying, well, you might want to question that and consider this from two different points of view, first house equals Aries or first house equals Cancer. Personally, I like the idea of the human race described by the moon and the sign Cancer initially, rather than by Mars and the sign Aries initially. We certainly need Mars and Aries, but hey, let's put that up on the 10th house where, we can be competitive stock traders or oil executives or something, or some form of people working on changing the world in some way, rather than have that be what defines a person inherently. I think humans are much more nurturing than we are competitive, and that for the most part we're competitive because we're conditioned to be competitive. Okay, so the purpose of this page again is tools, and the most important tools I've put here are whole sign houses. You can download the whole PDF, the Thema Mundi, this curious little chart with only seven planets and Cancer rising, and the Table of Essential Dignities according to Ptolemy. These could keep you busy for the rest of your astrological career, so don't think you're just going to know what these things are in one glance. I've put some supporting materials up, an article on the Thema Mundi, and an article that also helps explain the Chiron method of reading transits that we're going to do in a little while. Okay, so that's the basic introduction to the purpose of reading a natal chart and some very basic tools that will help you gain some grounding, that'll just help you have a tap into history and to, understanding where our work has come from. These ideas, these graphics don't tell you the state of mind of the early astrologers as much as they reveal the basic calculus that they were using for how to look at what fits in a chart. And, it would certainly be worth a major Planet Waves article or a separate class or a special Q&A session on this. But you do have these tools now. Okay. Any thoughts or questions? Haven't seen any hands. I would encourage you to just, be brave if you have a thought. And between topics, I will take any questions you have. This page is supposed to refresh itself, I think. And there are still no hands raised. Okay.
Hey, Eric, there was somebody in the chat room who asked if you could recommend some astrology software.
Yes. Okay, so that's basically for PC, Solifier, for Mac, IO Edition, and then there's some cheaper ones, and I'll have to research what they are, and I'll put them on this page. So bookmark the natal chart class page, and I will add that as resources. Also, serenu.com, S-E-R-E-N-N-U.com. I'll link that as well. It's linked from the Chiron Printable Ephemeris. Go to the ephemeris on that page, and you can look up all of the minor planets. You can look up the 120, 30 or so that I use the most often, and then you can add any other ones. So there's a free resource there to look up the minor planets, which are included in Solar Fire, but it's a little bit complicated getting them in. A bunch are included in IO edition, Time Cycles Research. But again, no one has as many as easily accessible as serenu.com, S-E-R-E-N-N-U. And if you go to the site regularly, please do donate a little bit, because she does the whole thing on a shoestring budget and sometimes has trouble paying her web service bill. Okay. I want to introduce you to a concept that's going to be helpful no matter what style of reading that you're doing. And if you could just take a look at the chart for Babe Ruth. That's the first of the natal charts. This is an awesome chart for every imaginable reason. It's perfect that this is Babe Ruth's chart. I think this chart is part of why we're still talking about him today, because he is such a lovable figure. But I want to introduce the concept of an aspect pattern, a group of planets that work together in the chart as a pattern. And the way to read this, the way to see this, is by the numbers. Now, I know the numbers next to the points confuse everyone, and I know I've got about 25 points in this chart, but I do suggest you get used to looking at charts with extra points so that you won't be intimidated by it. And that said, when I'm looking at an aspect pattern, I like to look at the classical planets first, the seven lights in the sky, the things that you can see with your naked eye, and then branch out from there. And Babe Ruth's chart's a very good chart for doing that, because it begins with Cancer rising and the moon rising. So here he is, this guy kind of has that moon face, and he's kind of, you know, squishy looking, and very friendly kind of guy who would hang out with little kids who came to the ballpark. And the chart starts here with Cancer rising and the moon rising. And if you start to look around the chart, you'll see there's lots of other things, especially classical planets, that are in the early degrees of the water signs in this case. So if you look up toward the ninth house, you can see that he's got a Mercury-Venus conjunction in early Pisces. That has a number value of 4 and 5. It's talking to the moon very clearly, and it's talking to the ascendant very clearly. If you look down toward the fifth house, you'll see that he has Saturn in Scorpio, in the fifth house. And so what he's got here is the moon in its rulership rising and making a trine to Venus, Mercury, and a trine to Saturn. So whether even if you're doing a tea leaf reading or if you're doing a counseling session, you need to see that pattern, that there's a grand trine pattern, and that it's especially influential because it makes contact with the ascendant. It is all connected to the rising sign, anchored by the moon rising. And so what do we get with this? Well, we know who we're looking at to some extent with Babe Ruth. We're talking about someone who was born in 1895, and we're still talking about him, and he's still a favorite of any baseball fan. And so we get this enduring quality with this chart. Now, to know really how this works, the thing to do would be to get a good biography of Babe Ruth and to plot this chart against his transits, to look at what happened, say, for example, when Saturn came through Cancer, to look at what happened when Chiron came through Cancer, to look at his Saturn return, and to see how this chart works when you actually put some energy into it. If we expand out to the modern planets, You can see that there is what looks to be a very powerful conjunction of Pluto and Neptune right in the 12th, and that is in a pattern that is opposite Pallas Athene. So you've got, again, an aspect pattern there, and you don't have to read what these patterns are. You just need to see them in the chart and then wait for further information or further confirmation from the person you're reading for. So we've got this extremely powerful Pluto-Neptune conjunction of 1895. A lot of people whose names we know were born in 1895. It was quite a year for people born who made an impact in the 20th century, and that has something to do with that Neptune conjunction there. Babe Ruth's son is trying that, and he's got Chiron in the mix, and so we see a second aspect pattern in the air signs. Just make a note of that. You don't need to say what it means. You'll find out what it means very easily when you start listening to the person whose chart this is. So if anyone wants to make, so Babe Ruth's birthday is in February. If anybody wants to make a project out of getting a Babe Ruth biography or two, or a chronology of his life, though the biography is going to be more helpful because it to give some detail and plot that against this chart and see what you get. Now, again, notice the approach I'm taking is a multidimensional approach where you've got a person, a chart, an astrologer, and then transits that are moving along and rattling the chart or buzzing it or making it vibrate or whatever exactly transits do. I'm not really sure what they do, but they certainly have an influence of some kind. And it is through this multidimensional view of the chart that the chart will come to life in a way that it just doesn't do when it's a flat piece of paper, static, looking at just one point where you're supposed to look at this thing and you're talking, somebody's sitting there looking at you and you're supposed to say something. It's a really limited way to do astrology. This unfolds things and makes it much easier. Okay, so I think we're up to the point where we can do the demo, and what I'm going to do is it's 10:53. I'm going to call a little break unless there's any questions that have come in. Let's just take a look at the Q&A. See all questions. Okay, so someone writes, I use astrology in my counseling practice. I'm assuming she's some kind of a therapist. Any suggestions for how to use, for this use of astrology specifically? Well, I think that as Carl Jung demonstrated, it helps to have the astrology to understand your client, but not to impose astrology on them. I think there's a ethical issue there in terms of whether we impose our interpretation on people, but you can certainly use the astrology to have insight and gain an understanding. And for example, if the person has a Virgo moon, you don't have to say that, but if they have a Virgo moon, you can listen for the ways in which they embody that, and then later if you look at their aspects, you might get a feeling for how this is influencing them in some way. You know, they might start to sound like they've got a Virgo moon, then you notice that the moon is square Pluto, and that Virgo moonness might be associated with some sense of that lone wolf quality of the moon square Pluto. So I think that understanding people is the best thing that we can do with astrology, is really get a feeling for who somebody is. And as a counselor, most of what you have to do is listen. And so the chart gives you one more thing to listen to. All right, seeing here, are there supposed to be slides on the screen? Chelsea, do we have an easy way to send out, maybe can you paste it into the Q&A or into the chat so that everyone can see this natal chart class materials? I know I've been talking about it now for 55 minutes.
I can probably put it in the chat room, but it's not something we can do within that one single slide. And there aren't any other slides because we're limited by the size and everything else. It just doesn't work well with the charts.
Okay. So
but
do you
I'll
have a quick way
it in the chat room.
Okay, awesome. And then is it possible, everyone just check your email for this link because this is the link that's going to tie together all the materials. And you'll need it to follow along when we do the sample reading. And we're going to start. Almost everyone in the class volunteered, by the way. Thank you for that. And I selected two of the charts. One is a primary chart, and then one is a secondary chart for a special case scenario involving people born in the millennial generation in the late 20th century. Okay, so just scanning through these questions. Okay, great. So, wow, a lot of people are tuned in. All right, I'm going to take a very short break, stick my head
outside.
Eric,
yes. Sorry to interrupt. There is one person who has their hand raised to ask a question in California, if you go back to the who's on the phone.
Hold on a second. All right. Hey.
Hello.
There. Yep,
yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Awesome.
Thank you. I have two questions. One of them is when you're referring to looking at Babe Ruth's chart and you're talking about the transit that electrify it, you're talking just generally transits when you go ahead and look up his Saturn return and, you know, any transits with Chiron. You're not looking at anything that's in the chart because the chart is static.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can see things from the chart, but in terms of transits, yeah, I'm saying it would be a lot of fun to take the timeline of Babe Ruth's life and see how it aligns, or to put Saturn in the ascendant, look up when that happened, and then look up in his biography what that time frame was about. So he was going to be he would have been around 21 years old when that happened. Obviously, an important time in a baseball player's life, right? If you're not playing baseball, if you're not already good at it by 21, so it's likely something very Saturn-like happened. And then, you know, move Chiron there. That's going to happen at some time in his probably in his late 30s or early 40s. And just to it gives you an added much deeper understanding of how this chart actually works rather than just sort of staring at all these planets standing still. So I think you've got that idea. Am I being clear enough about that?
Yes, I just wanted to make sure there wasn't any transits indicated here that I wasn't able to. Right, that's fine. That's perfect.
I like to work primarily with Chiron because primarily, not entirely, because it's so good at bringing out the chart in an objective way. But obviously, if you happen to know that there was a solar eclipse in a certain degree, I'm not seeing any. Well, actually, I mean there was a massive solar eclipse in his ascendant in 2001, but that's a little late for us to. You know, but who knows if they didn't open the Babe Ruth Museum in 2001, right? But if you know that there's a solar eclipse somewhere, if the person, for example, has, you know, they're born on the summer solstice, well, there was a huge solar eclipse in 2001. That's worth including when you're inquiring about their biography. If the person has a point at 12 and a half degrees of Virgo, and you happen to know that the Saturn-Pluto opposition happens exactly square, that ask about that time. After a while, you'll start to know these degrees, and they'll be interesting. Another interesting one is if someone has something in the Chiron discovery degree at 3 plus of Taurus, ask about 1977 because Chiron was discovered there. So it's an intuitive method, but initially, when you're first doing it, as I'll demonstrate, you want to use some very straightforward transits that are clear. You know, there's nothing fancy about them. They're just very distinctive. And you'll, after you've seen this work a few times, it'll be really obvious why it's a handy tool to have, and hopefully feel like you're going into water way over your head without a tool like this to use. And, you know, you save yourself the possibility of making a lot of mistakes. Are we good on that?
Yes.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Okay, yeah, so thanks for your question. Any other questions before I go stick my head outside the front door? All right. So it's 11:01. I'll see you back at 11:05. Welcome back. Okay. So Karen is Peter. Hey there, Karen. Karen?
Yes. Hello?
Howdy. Okay, you're on.
I'm on, yes.
Yes, you are. Okay. So, thanks for doing this.
Oh, you're welcome.
And so I'm going to talk to you, and I'm also talking to the class at the same time. So normally when I'm obviously doing this process, there's only two people involved. In this case, we have more like, 20 people involved.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll be dropping in little bits of commentary. So let me start with a little bit of commentary first. We've got Karen's natal chart up on the screen. Just make sure everyone has that up because it's going to be much more meaningful if you have that there, obviously. And where I'm getting my information from, though I've already written down all the transits, is from the Chiron Monthly Ephemeris that's at the very top of the page. Okay, so in this case, we've got natal chart, and then we've got the ability to look at Chiron transits. Now, again, we don't need to strictly look at Chiron transits. I'll often ask about the Saturn return and Uranian opposition. Probably not going to do that in this case because I'm just narrowing this down to about seven different transits. So the way I like to ask about the events of a person's life at the time of a transit is to ask where they were living. The problem with saying what happened is that the person might think you mean, did an airplane crash in the garden? Do you mean when World War VII broke out? So the idea here is to not be prodding for something big and traumatizing, but rather just to be getting a sense of the atmosphere, the conditions of a person's existence at that time. And I have found that the best way to do that is to ask them where they lived, what their address was. You don't need to know the address, but the address, people's addresses are very evocative. You know, if you say 612 Schenectady Avenue to me, that brings back a flood of memories of living in the first place I ever remember living. And so if you're asking me about, the summer of 1967, and I'll say where I was living, I'm suddenly grounded in a physical space, physical memories, a time frame, and then a story can emerge very easily from that. Okay, so Karen, one interesting thing about your chart, and I would not be telling people about their chart, by the way, but I've got you and you're an astrology student. The first transit I've selected is the first year of life.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I've selected the first year of life is because this chart has Chiron in the last degree of Aquarius. And in the first year of life, Chiron has made a conjunction to Venus, a conjunction to Ceres, a conjunction to the ascendant, and probably within a very short time, a conjunction to the south node. Right? So immediately, this chart comes under transits from Chiron from day one, basically. So you were born in Plattsburgh, New York, Karen?
Yes. On an airport base.
Where did you live and how would you describe it? I mean, I know you don't remember when you were zero, but maybe you saw pictures or people told you.
We lived on an Air Force base. My dad was a pilot, flying B-47s. My sister was born a year and a half later. Other than that, I don't even remember much.
What was the B-47?
B-47 is a bomber. So he would be, he would have periods of time away from home because he was on alert, so like for a few days, and then he'd go fly for hours, basically taking off, going around, a time where they were kind of on alert from the Russians and all that stuff, so they'd fly all around up by the Arctic Circle and around and land in the same place.
Was this the plane in Dr. Strangelove?
I'm not sure. It could be.
Okay, so just pausing here for a second, Karen.
Okay.
She said B-47s, charts 1961. I looked up the B-47. The B-47 indeed, Wikipedia says, primary mission was to drop nuclear bombs on the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to say what I think that means to you, but I think it's meaningful to both of us to know that your dad was on end of the world alert all the time.
I hadn't thought of it that way.
Okay. And so then if we keep that on file, right? You grew up on an Air Force base initially. You were born on one, as was your sister?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, like, what do you know about that era of your life from maybe from relatives or from your sister, from your mom?
The Air Force had kind of an indoctrination for young mothers at that particular time. You know, they told them how to be the best mom, how to have dinner on the table for their husbands, and make his life a perfect world. There was no stress from the family and all that. So my mom took that in and strove to be the perfect Air Force wife. That's
right.
What I remember.
How did that work out for her?
She took that to her deathbed.
Okay.
But it was a lot of keeping harmony when other things were seething underneath. We didn't fight in our family. We didn't have big arguments or anything like that. There was this kind of perfect family aura.
Right.
So I took that one way.
Go ahead.
Pardon?
I was going to say the perfect nuclear family.
Correct. Yeah. I took it one way. My sister took it another way.
How did she take it?
She was the voice of saying things that no one wanted to hear. So she was the loud one, the one that was saying things, and she didn't feel very supported in saying things that were actually going on, but no one wanted to hear.
Right. So now one of the techniques I use, just pausing our conversation, Karen, is when someone mentions a sibling, I just glance over at the third house. Not to read it to the person, not to say anything. It may speak up. The conductor may need to point at that part of the chorus to bring it out, but we don't need to do that yet. We just need to be aware of the third house. And in this chart, the third house is Taurus. Nessus is in the third, and Venus is right there, conjunct Chiron. So we just know that's there, and we just start to assemble the picture of your family structure from that. And then we keep moving along. Now, you were born, again, an aside here. I would not say this to a client. What I'm trying to do in this reading is to keep the astrology totally transparent.
Mm-hmm.
I always run into this mix when I'm demonstrating the process in a class and explaining what I'm doing while I'm doing it. I should try it without the explaining it sometime, but for this class, I'm going to explain it. Chiron is moving very slowly in Pisces and in Aries. Chiron is furthest from the sun when it's in Pisces, Aries, and Taurus. And so it's moving slowly through the solar system. And so the next, for our purposes, significant Chiron transit is Chiron square Jupiter. And that takes place 72-73. So can everyone see that, how Chiron has moved through Pisces and it's gone into Aries, and then it makes a major aspect, meaning a square, to Jupiter and the Sun and Mercury and Saturn all right around the same time. And that happens in 72-73. So where were you living when you were about 12?
Benita, California.
And how did you get there?
My dad became a pilot for Pan Am and moved down to San Diego. Both he and my mom were born and raised in San Diego area.
Right.
So he wanted to come home.
Right. So he was done in service.
Yes. Yes. He got out right before the Vietnam War.
Yeah. Good. That's really a good thing.
Yeah, it is.
Not that flying. If you want to know something about Karen's dad's job, get Dr. Strangelove. This is just like I recommend The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir for anybody who is a man or a woman. Dr. Strangelove is one of those movies that we need to understand why we are the way we are. And you'll see a crew of what I'm pretty sure is a B-47, whose job is to fly around Antarctica, ready to dip into Soviet territory. And you'll know what these guys were dealing with 24/7 on these planes refueling in mid-flight. So I would say going to California to fly for Pan Am was a relief. Probably. How did you like it in San Diego?
Yeah, we loved it in San Diego.
Ah, good.
We water skied all the time. It was good.
Mhm. Yeah, you can't say that about Plattsburgh.
No.
Which is up in the mountains in upstate New York. It is chilly up there.
Yes, it was.
And what about school?
School, I think I just moved from one elementary school to the next, or maybe it's junior high.
Was that military thing, because you're moving bases, or?
No, we moved from Plattsburgh to Travis Air Force Base, which is in Northern California, and then my dad got a job with PSA after he left, and I don't know the year he left the service. I think it was after 10 years.
What's PSA?
With PSA, yeah.
What is PSA?
Oh, PSA is since you're on the East Coast, it's a West Coast airline that just flew in California, Oregon, I think, Washington, Nevada, Arizona. So it was short hops.
Got it. Got it. And then moved on to Pan Am.
No, actually, I flew for Pan Am. I misspoke there.
Oh, wait. Wait, you're a pilot also?
Correct.
Got it. Okay. So your dad, you flew for Pan Am. Your dad didn't fly for Pan Am.
Yes.
He flew for PSA.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. All righty. So let's, now, because Chiron's going so slowly, so we're not, but by the way, we're getting, there's nothing that especially stands out about this transit except that you're describing it as seems to be a settled, peaceful time in your life.
Correct, yes.
When your family came home, your mom and dad both came home, I'm sure that felt good for them to, you know,
yes.
Be where they grew up. Okay, so the next transit in this sequence is Chiron square Chiron, first Chiron square, and that's in 83-84. So that would have you about 22, 23 years old.
Uh-huh.
Where were you living at that age?
I was living in Cameron Park. I was living with my parents, and I was getting my instructor's rating as a pilot.
Mm-hmm. Really, at 22 years old?
Yes, 22.
Uh huh. So, when did you start flying?
I started flying in 1978. I got my private pilot's license at the end of high school.
Right. So I'm guessing your dad influenced that.
Yes. I guess I said I wanted to be a flight attendant or a stewardess back then. And he goes, I don't think so. Why don't you learn how to fly? And I was like, okay.
are you grateful for that?
I'm very grateful.
he had a vision for you.
He did.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing, you know. It could have gone the other way. I mean, so without, I might not necessarily say something about this, but, you know, your dad does show up as a mighty figure in this chart. Obviously, Sun conjunct Jupiter, Mercury, and Saturn. I mean, that's a lot of dad.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And
right.
And to point you in that direction, right?
Right.
I mean, flight attendant, I mean, he saw how ludicrous that concept was, and he obviously knew how smart you were.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the biggest plane you've ever flown?
C-141.
So
it's a four-engine cargo airplane.
Yeah. So, you know, he could see that in you. All right. So at Chiron Square Chiron, 83, 84, you're getting your instructor certification, and then where do you go from there?
Then I fly as a flight instructor a couple jobs, and then through that experience, learned that I want to join the Air Force Reserves, and my father helped me get into the Air Force Reserves, and I went to pilot training in 85. 86. The end of 85, 86.
And what was that like?
Pilot training was great. There was a little bit of problem with line formation, but I figured it out and passed them.
And what kind of airplanes?
T-37 and T-38. T-38 is like it's really fast, really fun airplane. It's an F-4.
Mm-hmm. All right. So it sounds like you're moving up in the world.
Mm-hmm.
No pun intended. And as an aside to students listening, is that one thing I've noticed is that basically as people go through these Chiron transits, their lives tend to either get steadily worse or steadily better. I call them spiral up and spiral down type charts. And, you know, what we're seeing is someone here who's, consistently growing and taking opportunities. And, you know, the fact of having a supportive father, for a woman to have a supportive father, just makes me warm and tingly all over and means I have almost nothing to worry about with my client. Okay. 93, 94, Chiron still going kind of slow. Chiron opposite Chiron. Can everyone see these transits? By the way, please do make sure you can actually see these transits. Let's just look at Chiron square Chiron, 83, 84. That would be Chiron at the end of Taurus, because Chiron is at the end of Aquarius in this chart. So Chiron at the end of Taurus is going to give a Chiron square, transiting square, and that there's always an interesting turning point in someone's life at that point. Look it up in your chart. Look it up in everybody's chart that you know and hear their stories of their Chiron squares. Okay, so the next one moving along using this abbreviated palette of transits is Chiron opposite Chiron in 93 and 94. Now what's interesting is because you waited so long to have your Chiron square, you didn't have your Chiron square till you were in your early 20s. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That means the opposition is going to come along pretty soon after that.
Okay.
Kids who were born in, like, say, for example, in 2000, or have had their Chiron. Let's say you're born in like 95. You're going to have your Chiron square at 7. Whereas if you're born in 61, you're going to have your Chiron square at 21 or 22. So there's a wide variance in these, and that's part of what makes Chiron so interesting. So you had your square in first square in 83, 84, and you're going to have your second square in 93, the opposition rather, 93, 94. So what were you doing in, where were you living in 93, 94?
93, 94. I was living in San Mateo, and the birth of my first child was happening in 93, March of 93. And I had stopped flying by then.
Okay. So let's put that on hold for 1 second. Your Saturn return happened right before that. In 90-91. So what can you tell me about
90-91? I was married to a German at that particular time. We were starting to break up. I was flying for Pan Am, and Pan Am went out of business, so I stopped that. I was still flying for the reserves. I was commuting from Germany to California to Travis Air Force Base. So there was a lot of a lot of tumultuous events going on.
Well, it sounds like your life wasn't very stable.
No, it was very unstable at that particular time.
Right. So you had your partner was in Germany, in other words, but you were flying for the reserves in California.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, and then within a couple of years, sounds like a new relationship and a child.
Yes. And giving up my career.
Right. Yeah, which you embarked on really young.
In my early 30s.
Yeah, I mean, but you had, you were an instructor in your early 20s.
Right.
Okay, and so first child born, and where were you living?
San Mateo, California.
And what can you tell me about that?
We lived in a condo. My partner, because we weren't married then, was a pilot for United, and And he was separated. He wasn't divorced yet. And he was older than I am, 18 years older than me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to the next date, which is Chiron,
okay.
Square Chiron. Now notice how quickly the Chiron first square opposition and second square happened for people born in the 60s. Second square is 1999. So the second square is when Chiron reaches the 90-degree point. So you've got Chiron in late Aquarius. So therefore, when Chiron gets to late Scorpio, that's the second square. And so talking about the millennial era, 99, where were you?
I was in Boulder, Colorado.
And what can you tell me about your life there?
I have three boys, under the age of 10. One was 2, one was 5, and one was 6. So I was full-time taking care of the boys. My husband, we were married by then, and he went back to school to study law. So he was in the midst of getting his law degree and starting a practice. So he was gone a lot. He was gone a lot. I was basically raising the kids by myself.
Right. And was how did you find that easy, hard, just how things were?
I took on the let's keep on a pleasant face about everything that I learned as a small child and just, dealt with it the best I could.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, next transit is about 4 years later, where Chiron now is in Capricorn, and it's making a conjunction to Jupiter and the Sun. It's making a conjunction to that Capricorn group. Right. So what can you tell me about that and where you were and what was up there?
So that was like in 2005, 2004?
Yeah, 2003.
Oh, 2003. Boulder, Colorado, still basically doing the same thing with the kids, raising the kids. My husband was working as a lawyer and flying at that particular time. Or he was going to be, and I think he was retiring that year.
From both law and flying?
No, he retired from flying that year and started becoming a lawyer full-time.
Mm-hmm. About how old was he then?
60.
Okay. And where were you at with that relationship?
He was just working full time. I was still very supportive of him working and all that stuff. So our relationship was okay at that particular time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, at this phase, Chiron is starting to slow down. The next transit I have on my short list is the Chiron return, but I want to check one in between that because I'm listening for what happens to this relationship. Basically, you've still got that awesome composure. This is what happens to me. Everything's fine.
It starts cracking later.
Okay, so hold on one second here, and let's see what that. So the next one I'm going to look up is when Chiron gets out to around, 07. So 2007.
In 2007, still basically the same. I didn't do any cracking open. I think things start, I start realizing that I'm not living the fairy tale. But I'm not ready to do any major moves or anything. It's just, I think of a basic not being happy with life, with my husband, starts slowly creeping in around that time.
Can you say more about that thought process?
Our relationship, Okay, my husband started drinking more when he started becoming a lawyer. And so that starts to slowly divide the family a bit. And so there's this slow division of this slow process of realizing that this guy has a lot of problems he's not willing to face or look at, and how much do I want to just continue holding the space for the family and nothing happened in 2007. I mean, nothing probably started really happening until the Chiron return.
Right.
And further.
Were you figuring out stuff that you didn't know, or is it more like you were just willing to admit what you hadn't been willing to admit?
A little of both. I wasn't really aware, and yeah, I'm so wrapped up in trying to keep a pleasant face on things and have a good life. I didn't want to look at it at all.
Right. Are you in touch with your mom through any of this?
Yes. Yeah, my mom and dad are very. Yes, but mom couldn't go deep with me. Mom and dad don't go deep into relationships. They keep it kind of surfacey.
Who's the other person?
My mom and dad.
Ah, I see. Ah, so they.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I get it. So it seems to me like your legacy is about penetrating through this, not going so deep.
Right. Right.
Going deep.
Yes. So as long as you keep it light and airy and not go too deep, then things are okay. But if you start probing in relationships and looking at really what is instead of what you hope there is, then the shit hits the fan.
Right. So just as a astrologer note here, let's bookmark that at the shit hitting fan, that you will have clients who come to you before they have started probing and are still keeping the happy face on things and striving to live the fairy tale. And then you'll have clients who show up in the middle of the transition, and you'll have the ones who, in the case of Karen, arrive somewhat after she's made these big decisions that she's in the course of our narrative is about to make. One other thing also is that that when Chiron gets into your 12th house, that's when you seem to get some introspection. That's when you seem to start opening up, right? Isn't it interesting that Chiron goes into Aquarius? You have Aquarius on the 12th, and that's when you're describing the inner vision starting to happen.
I just also realized that starting around in 2008, my oldest, well, all the kids, they started getting into drugs, and so there was a lot of tension, and the fallout probably started happening around 2008 slowly. Of the relationship with the boys, because there's a lot of hidden levels of drug use, of finding out, of oppositions between my husband and I and how to deal with it and how much to tell my husband because he freaks out different and it's not a pleasant thing. So there's a lot of hidden stuff that was coming out, I guess, and those from about 2008.
Right.
I don't know if that makes a difference.
Sure. Well, in terms of studying astrology, this is, you know, there's two ways to learn the houses. One is through through reading different descriptions of them. And another way is to observe transits. And so what we're observing is a Chiron 12th transit with a lot of planets in the 12th. Meaning a lot of material in that dimension of the 12th house that starts to emerge as Chiron goes in there. And the 12th also represents the environment into which you're born. You know, so you're born into this family situation where your mom is taking, you know, Betty Crocker classes.
And learning how, we have a good book.
You know, learning how, you know, K rations suck, and then you come home and you can have a good home cooked meal. And so that's, I had no idea this program existed. I've seen the videotapes of teaching men how to shave, but I did not know there was a program for military wives. I'm sure it was mostly for officers. Okay, so Chiron return is 2010. It's 10-11, 10-2010, 10-2011. What can you tell us about that time?
A lot of unhappiness in my marriage and a lot of questioning of what am I doing here, and just questioning whole life, marriage,
How long
do I need to stay?
Right. How are you feeling in the midst of that questioning?
How do I stay? How do I go? How do I support myself? How do I handle these kids? They have problems. A lot of financial stuff. I haven't worked in over, since 93 as a pilot. Can I support myself? You know, what am I going to do? And how do I get there? And there's a lot of fear, of course, with that whole thing.
Right. And what are the options you're looking at?
Leaving my husband. But what do I? What do I do with my kids? And so I'm basically sitting in this unhappiness at the moment in 2011, 2010.
Right. Okay. And what's the next step you take?
The next step I take is, well, 2013 we split in the summer of 2013.
How did that happen? How did the discussion go?
okay. Well, there's some backtracking, I suppose, to that story. So our two of our children in, let's see, one in 2012, he gets kicked out of college, our oldest, on drug-related charges. So he goes to rehab and all that stuff. Our second child starts doing that in November of 2012. He goes to a different rehab in the beginning of his senior year. So we have two kids, you know, we're just holding together, surviving this thing with the kids. But by the time summer of 2013 hits, There's a lot of distrust between my husband and I, and we decided to call it quits. I'm living at my sister's house with our youngest. And he wants to settle with me, and I decided to go for the lawyers. So it's a big battle, a big drawn-out battle with money between them, because he doesn't want to... He didn't want to, support me. So that's it in a nutshell. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in between, but.
Right. And then after the marriage, what's your, like, after you split, what's the first step you take?
To find a place to live on my own.
Right. Are you having any kids with you at this point, or they've all left the home?
Our youngest is with us, with me.
And how's he doing?
He doesn't want it.
How was he doing?
Oh, he was a mess. He was an emotional mess. Because I was in Europe when we started really splitting, and my husband's very emotionally and mentally abusive. And our youngest and my oldest was living at home at that point. They're both took the bulk of that.
Right.
Yeah, so my oldest one, he got, when I came home, the couple days after I came home, he landed himself in jail. And so he took himself out of the equation, and my youngest came to stay with me. So it was a lot of emotional hardship that was just kind of really, really tough on everybody.
Right. And it sounds like everything's kind of unraveled all at once.
Yeah, it did.
Right. Okay. And how are you doing today?
I'm doing much better, much better. We're divorced. I have money to live on. I'm trying to figure out what I want to do with the rest of my life. I have some ideas. The kids are in much better places. They're each recovering. And they're clean, so that's good.
Uh-huh.
It's been a hell of a journey, but it's over. Or not over, but that part of the story is over.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing all that.
You're welcome.
So, do you have your chart up on the screen, Karen?
I do.
So, for you and for the people who are listening, I mean, obviously, you know, we've been talking to Karen for a little over half an hour, right? We started at about 10 after 11, and so that's like 40 minutes. So in 40 minutes, we know more than, a lot more than we knew just looking at a chart with a person sitting across the table. And it's really interesting how this played out astrologically, of course. I mean, you could look at your chart and see that Pluto North Node in the seventh like that, and say, this person's got a very powerful draw into relationships, and it's an evolutionary thing because Pluto's there and the North Node is there, and it's there. You know, there's an intensity to your devotion. It's in Virgo. There's a service orientation. You give up your career. You've got this incredibly diverse resume as a pilot. I can't imagine anybody who has flown that much who doesn't just fucking love flying. I mean, you know, and so you're willing to give that up to do something else for someone. You know, you're involved, but there's a relationship involved, and that's that Pluto 7th North Node Virgo. I mean, that is powerful. And let's just check that while we've got that up on the screen. I'm surprised they didn't list that one, but let's see what... Pluto was in Virgo, I think it's around 95. So I might have covered that through another transit. 90. Okay, so 1994, Pluto crosses your seventh house cusp. So we covered that in the Chiron opposite Chiron transit, and that's when you're having your first child.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that first child, right, things, I'm gathering, things seem good at that point. The marriage seemed workable and you were happy to be where you were. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
And then as Chiron goes from the seventh house cusp, the relationship angle, all the way over the top of the chart and down through the 10th, 11th, 12th, and emerges across the ascendant, you've come 180 degrees. You've woken up to your situation, you're fully out of denial, you're now making choices and taking action, and you make a choice not to accept a buyout, but rather to confront the situation directly,
mm-hmm.
and set yourself free from the situation. Chiron crossing the ascendant and the North Node. So are you getting a feeling for
yeah.
how that worked?
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that ascendant area, that south node in the first demonstrates a, you know, a steadfastness about who you are, the ability to, you know, keep being that person. And it's not until Chiron starts to get near that through the 12th that you start to make contact. And there's this gradient as Chiron moves through the 12th, changes signs into Pisces, and then touches off Venus, Ceres, the ascendant. And the, right, you could probably plot this by the month with the developments in the relationship. And it might be very interesting to do that, to make a timeline of those events and the discussions and the court proceedings, and then to plot it against the transits and to see the developments, one development at a time. And that steadfastness of the south node rising like that unravels when Chiron gets there. That's when you can see the karma of the whole thing for what it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's something as powerful as Pluto, not the abducted or voluntarily abducted Ceres Demeter story there in Ceres, but something of an equal weight and influence as Pluto, which clearly Chiron is, even though Jeff Green never read Chiron in a chart. But it is a counterbalancing point to that Pluto. It's almost kind of like an inversion of Pluto. It's the conscious expression of Pluto. And now, you know, when you finally get that in your ascendant, you find yourself, you align with yourself, and emerge in a whole new form. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair to say, yes.
So, and we know that because we've heard, basically heard you say that in not quite so few words, but describe this gradient. Okay, so, and obviously these transits continue, but Chiron is now back to being slow, you know, moving slowly through, you know, Pisces. It's going to slow down even more to go through Aries. It goes through Aries in 9 years, Pisces in about 8. And I have learned something about astrology from having this conversation with you, so thank you. Every one of these charts just is almost like a book, basically. As you hear these experiences related to the transits, I mean, I'm, you know, palpably feeling you and this chart and your story in a way that I can't imagine I would have were I just have looked at a sheet of paper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so any thoughts or questions?
For me?
Well, if you want to follow up about this, just contact me directly or contact Chelsea, and then we'll set aside time and have a conversation without a class present, and I'd be happy to, you know, hear from you again and field any questions you have. So why don't we just leave it at that? How's that, Karen?
Okay.
And thank you again. All right. Okay, so you've gotten a sense of how to do this, right? So I suggest that you first start with yourself and plotting your own transits. When I discovered, I remember the moment that I discovered this. I had read that it was possible to do it, and when I read that it was possible to do this, I called up Dave Rell at the Astrology Center of then Astrology Center of Southern California, who would cast all my astrology before I had a program. And I asked him for a list of my Chiron transits. I was about maybe 29 or 31 years old. And the first transit on the list, because I was born in the 60s, was my Chiron first square. And Chiron first square was exact one day once, June 1st, 1986. And I recognized that date because it's the date that's printed on my university degree from the University of Buffalo. That's the official date of my graduation. And my story of going through university was a huge part of my life. You know, I founded a magazine and I was involved in setting up a political dynasty. And then at the end, there were a number, you know, I had some very hard lessons about what it means to be involved in politics, and right around that same time, the Chernobyl nuclear disaster happened right in that spring, in April of 1986, and then this culminates with, you know, I discovered everything about myself pretty much that was going to be relevant for the rest of my life. I didn't know all the nuances, but for all the huge pieces, I knew I would be an environmental journalist. I understood that I wasn't a normal kind of monogamous person, that I had some other thing going on, that I understood that I couldn't be in politics anymore as a direct participant in politics, as a campaign general. And when I saw that date on that list and it matched to the day of the day printed on my degree, I thought, there is something going on here. And then the next one, time goes on, and is the summer of 1994. And I'm deeply involved in the PCB situation at SUNY New Paltz. I'm covering the history of dioxins in Monsanto for a worldwide publication, Sierra Magazine. I've sued New York State. And right at my Chiron opposition, my biggest journalistic achievement to that time comes out. I win my lawsuit against New York State. Again, time down to about the month. So I thought, this is amazing. I've got to see how these transits work for everyone. And I've gone through the process that you've just heard probably 1,500 times with people. And we just took 45 minutes to do this. It's a very well-invested 45 minutes. Now, I don't know what I'm going to talk about with Karen in a week or two, but I can tell you that it's going to be an interesting conversation, and we'll both learn something, and that it will be a very different conversation than we would have had without my having had that insight. And it's difficult into her life, as told by her, and it's not easy to get this kind of information from someone by saying, tell me your life story. You just don't open up like that. But if you slowly take it from place to place over time, the place brings in the events, and the events bring in the theme, and the theme brings in the motives for growth and for change. And you can see the way in which basically in the course of one Chiron cycle, she completely integrated her chart. I mean, this is really, there's not really a textbook about this, and I'm not a big fan of them, but a kind of a textbook case of how this works. But your chart, too, will be a textbook case. I know it's approaching noon. I'd like to spend some time with April's chart, and I just want to check one group of transits and make one point about millennial births because of the concentration of movement of Chiron. So you're invited to stay on, and then I'll stay for a while and take some Q&A if we've got that. Okay, so I'm going to call on April. Hello, April, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Okay, welcome.
Thanks.
Okay, so thanks for volunteering your chart, first of all. The thing about your chart that makes it both interesting and a little bit challenging to read in this method is something that all people doing this method need to be aware of, which is that from when Chiron was in about sign Cancer in the late 1980s till it moved past Libra and Scorpio in the late 1990s for a period of about 10 or 15 years, Chiron covered a lot of ground in a very short time. And so
Sounds about right.
So if people have especially if people have concentrations of planets, and of course if you're born in 1980, 1985, you're youngish, you haven't had that much experience. So there's a special challenge in doing this, which began to creep in as time went on, and I started working with people who were born later and later in time, because almost all of my initial clients were born in the 1950s. So I've spent my life reading for basically, even to this day, I would say the majority of my clients are born. It's kind of amazing. People in the 1950s really like to come in for astrology readings. maybe because I read Linda Goodman books and got a good impression of astrology. But the later people are born, the more transits they're going to have concentrated, but they haven't lived that long.
Right.
Can you see that? So this makes it a little bit tricky, and because people's life phases tend to move in, it takes like a year or two to go through a phase, and things can start to seem to blur into one another. So you've got to be subtle about this. And so I don't have these notes printed up, but were I to do the same process with you, I would very meticulously check, for example, I would look at Chiron conjunct Ceres, and then I would look at Chiron conjunct Venus-Sun. That's right there.
Uh-huh.
And then I would look at Chiron conjunct Nessus 7th Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
So the more concentrated it gets, the more you have to pick out distinct individual transits and go into more detail. Now, by the time Chiron clears out of Cancer and is in Leo, it basically goes from Leo to Libra, like in about 3.5 years.
Uh-huh.
So let's just check a couple of your transits, just to get a flavor of a second kind of chart pattern in time. These are both kind of locomotive-ish, kind of like concentrated, a lot of concentrated energy in your chart, and a lot concentrated in the eighth house, which is never boring. It's impossible in the things in the universe. Nothing's impossible except for an eighth house chart to be boring. Chiron reaches your seventh in, that's at 16 degrees of Cancer, and so that is in 89. So where were you in 1989, April?
This is probably just the beginning. So I was 9 years old. I was probably about in third grade. So from that point in my life, my home life was really stable. I had my last brother was born in 88, so I had three younger brothers. But in 89, I moved from Idaho to Phoenix. And that was the beginning of, I changed schools from that time on, every year from third grade till sophomore year.
Right. I mean, very rapid acceleration of progress.
Right. Every year I moved. I was in a new location.
You moved, physically moved every year. So
correct.
Things are stable up to the point of Chiron coming above the horizon. And it makes that series of conjunctions, and then you move every year?
I change schools physically every year from third grade to sophomore year.
Why did that happen?
My parents decided to move from Idaho to Arizona, and then we just kind of moved from apartment to apartment or house to house within that location, and then my mom, and it was actually my stepfather, they separated when I was around 11 or 12, and then my mom was like a single mother, and I lived with different aunts, and I was just kind of just moving all the time.
Right.
So.
Right. Okay. So let's just look at the next point of contact, which is that Chiron, that pink thing with the slash is a hypothetical called Trans-Pluto. I may be the last astrologer who uses it.
Uh-huh.
But I find it to be interesting, and it happens to be guarding the gate of your eighth house. And so that is 17 Leo, and according to the ephemeris, Chiron gets there in 92.
Yeah, so that's when my mom and my stepdad split, and he just basically dropped out of the picture altogether. I was the oldest, and I was basically a second parent to my brothers and a emotional support to my mother. I kind of just had to grow up real fast right then.
Right.
Yeah. My mom was in school full time, and she was working full time.
Right.
And I was, cooking dinner, helping with homework, doing baths, all that.
And going to school.
Yes. Yeah, I was 12 years old. I was a child.
You were 12?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So then Chiron changes signs again and makes contact with your moon in the second degree of Virgo for the first time in 93. So that's the next year.
Right. Yeah, so by then my mom actually was more intense into school, and so she sent me and two of my brothers. She was still in Arizona, and we went to Idaho to live with her stepsister, and so I kind of had a little break from the caretaking I was doing and got to just be a kid, and I was getting taken care of by my aunt in Idaho.
Right. How did that feel?
It was great. I did a lot of things that I had never had a chance to do before. I learned how to ski, and we were water skiing and hiking and camping and, just a lot of really fun outdoor activities. And my cousin was exactly my age, so I had, kind of a proxy sister.
Mm-hmm.
That I got to spend time with, and, it was just really fun.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then the next year, Chiron reaches the Mars-Saturn conjunction.
So then I went back to Phoenix to live with my mom, and then she graduated, and then we all moved back to Idaho. she got an internship in Idaho, and we kind of all lived in it. So there was five of us, four kids and my mom, living in a two-bedroom apartment. So I shared a room with my mom, and just kind of went on from there.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's look at one more. And again, I would not be calling out these transits unless I was in an astrology class. So when you do this with someone, especially a non-astrologer, keep mum about the name of the transit. You can bring that in later, but my rule is to use astrology when it's the only thing that can illustrate the point or to answer a specific question about astrology. So the next transit I'm going to look for is Chiron conjunct Pluto, and that's at 19 Cancer. Or rather, Libra, sorry. I'm getting a little fatigued here. Cancer. Okay, that's in 96.
So at that point, my mom had a job, but she was moving cities again, and I decided to go back to Phoenix to live with my other aunt.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I had an opportunity to go to a school that I had, I had known people that went to that school, and my aunt was going through a divorce, so I kind of stepped in and helped her in kind of a similar way that I had helped my mom, and I basically just went to Phoenix to live, and help my aunt with her kids and her divorce, and also have the opportunity to be in a somewhat familiar location to finish out my high school career.
Right. So you made a choice to put some stability in your life.
Right.
Finally, you
somewhat.
Somewhat.
Yeah.
How did that? What was the other part of the somewhat?
Well, I mean, I was still helping my aunt through her craziness.
Oh, I see. Right.
And it did affect kind of my future later, but it was, it all worked out.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I was able to kind of connect with people that had been part of my past, and so I was not in such a foreign environment for my last high school years.
Right. Got it. Yeah, well, I would certainly be curious to, see the rest of these transits. If you'd like to journal them out, Chiron conjunct Midheaven, which is kind of your Chiron opposition. The square is when your mom and stepdad split, by the way. When Chiron goes into your eighth, it also squares Chiron. So that's one transit event.
Uh-huh.
And then, a couple of other big ones were the opposition, and that's conjunct Uranus. And then Chiron 12th, you've got Neptune right there. And then conjunct the ascendant. So you've actually had, now that a little more time has gone on, quite a few Chiron transits. And then Chiron's going to way slow down as it moves through Pisces, Virgo, and Aries. So you'll have fewer of them. Okay. So, again, contact me if you have any direct personal questions, April. And thanks for volunteering your chart for this.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. I'm going to meet you again. Okay, a couple of closing thoughts. One is that there may be we've seen with both of our volunteer charts that they are sensitive to Chiron transits. And that's really the first thing that you're looking for. Whether there's some, movement in their life when there's a Chiron transit. It's a little spooky when there's not, because it's so dependable, because this, whether you can predict what's going to happen is or not is one thing, but the fact that there will be some movement is true about 95% of the time. So when there's someone who's just not, their life is not changing or moving, that requires special handling, but it's not really going to happen that often, and they might also not be saying anything that really matters. The second thing is there may be dates that people don't remember. When someone does a lot of not remembering, you have to start listening for trauma. And though you might not be a trained trauma counselor, the blankouts are, they tend to indicate a pattern of something that it's necessary to forget for the person. But there's also that experience where we're going through these transits and the person blanks out on one transit. There's one in that first conversation. There's one date. You may go through 8 or 9 dates and they don't remember one individual one. Don't even worry about that. I've had it happen more times than I can count that the person doesn't remember a date and then the phone rings 3 days later, or I get an email, oh my God, I can't believe I even forgot this. Or they'll say it the next week when I have them back in. I would suggest that you set a goal of doing this process with 10 people this summer. Just pick any 10 people, put an ad in the paper or network through your friends, or you should definitely work with some people that you've never met before just to get the feeling of what it's like to work with someone that you're completely unfamiliar with. You might find that it's actually quite easy. And just run through this process with 10 people. And at the end of that, I think you'll be pretty well grounded in it and have an awesome tool in your hands to be able to actually work with people in a meaningful way without taking stabs in the dark about what their chart is supposed to mean, and without doing this, something that I consider to be very commonplace in astrology but rather blatantly unethical, of imposing the interpretation on the person as if that's the way that they're supposed to be. Very fine line we have to walk when interpreting, so as not to impose our beliefs on people, but to provide something that is of tangible value. Okay, so any thoughts here? Any questions that you might have about this or how to do this in your own chart? You can click star 2 to raise your hand. Let's check in the Q&A queue, see all questions. Let me see if Chelsea's had anything to say. Okay, so I'm not seeing Chelsea online. Okay, so a question here from someone. How does one look at a chart and see times? I see symbols. Okay, so this is, we'd need to go back to how to spot a transit. You're not seeing the time in the chart, you're seeing the time in the ephemeris. You're looking in the ephemeris, the thing that's on the resources page, and you are matching up the degree and the sign. What I suggest that we do is, from this point, we use this group as a resource for learning how to do this, and that we buddy up in groups of 2 or 3, and anyone who wants to opt out of this process, please write to Chelsea. If you want to opt in, please write to Chelsea, and we'll set up a group list in our mail server program to give people the opportunity to get together and to review this and go over and to explain this. Okay, a lot of short type questions here that would be very long to explain. What I can do is, okay, so Chelsea's saying, all right, so what I can do here is I can respond to some of these on the class page, and we can come back to that. And then also, obviously, this, I think, you know, material is designed to go over the heads of some people and fill in the blanks for some people, but let's get a discussion group going so that we can build on this process and actually fill in the blanks and fill in the questions, and then I'll offer some insights on that. But just briefly to address the grand trine, the way you would see that is when you see a lot of planets grouped in the early water signs, that's a grand trine. Or grouped anywhere in the same element, all three of that element, that is a grand trine. And the way you see that is primarily with signs and knowing the element and then noticing the degree number to see how close that grand trine is. So take a look in Babe Ruth's chart and look at all the planets in the low, in the early degrees of the water signs. And I'll explain that underneath Babe Ruth's chart with a little paragraph explaining how to see that. Okay, I'm not seeing any hands raised. Let me just scan back through the Q&A to see if there's something that I can handle here in the little bit. I know almost half an hour over time. I'm not seeing anything I can handle in short format, but we'll have this list set up over the weekend. If you are one of the people who's one of my astrology students on the Alpha class list or on the editor's list or eco list, and you've been in this class, just let Chelsea know that fact so we can include you on this list, and then we'll take every one of the names on this list and put it on a little dynamic listserv so that everyone can you'll see everyone else's email to opt out. Just tell Chelsea that you want to opt out. Then what I will suggest is that we'll organize a way to find buddies or just announce it and work in groups of two or three and run through this process, and you will soon be able to figure out how to spot these transits and then how to ask them. And I suggest you be on both sides of the table at least twice and then venture forth into the world and start, basically asking people if they want to do an astrological interview. Okay, so not seeing any additional hands raised, please do. Now's your chance. Is there one? Ah, there is. Okay, so this is Clarissa in L.A. I'm going to unmute you. Hey there, Clarissa.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for the class.
How's it working? Am I doing my job?
Yes, definitely. And
I can't quite tell without the feedback, so thanks for raising your hand.
My pleasure. Learned a lot by listening to what you were doing with Karen and April.
Mm-hmm.
That was really great.
Awesome.
So my question is regarding north nodes and south nodes in charts. I remember reading in one of your writings that you look at the houses they're in more important than the actual signs. And I was just wondering how you incorporate the north node and south node in a chart when you're looking at them.
Well, one thing you can do is you can look at the Chiron transits to those points. So we saw that in action in Karen's chart, right? In when Chiron's on the north node and Pluto in her chart, she's full on into her marriage and having her first of three children. That's the north node and the seventh.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chiron does a 180, and her worldview based in the marriage is shifting radically. So that gives a real life test of what these points are and how they work. I would describe, though, without using a transit method, the nodes as being anchor points into reality is the most important thing that they are. They're grounding points. They're tethers into the physical plane. And the other way to suss out the nodes, again, without looking at transits, but this gives you insight into transits, is to use the sign placement of the node. Say, let's, for example, in Babe Ruth's chart, the north node is in Pisces. His Jupiter is going to tell you something about the north node. It's going to elaborate something about the north node. Now, I don't know that much about Babe Ruth, but I do know that Jupiter in the 12th, I mean, he's got this larger-than-life sensation, right? I mean, it's fucking Babe Ruth. I mean, so how can you be much larger than life than Babe Ruth? And the ruling planet of the node, by ruling planet, I mean the planet that rules the sign that the node is in, will help elaborate the node. And in the case of the south node, that's in Virgo. And so the ruling planet of Virgo is Mercury. And we would look at Mercury and study the condition of Mercury. Now, the nodes are one of the more challenging and contentious points in the chart, and there's not really that much that's that good written about them. A lot of what's been written about them is pretty heavily slanted, especially Martin Shulman's book, which gives you a clue. It's one of the only popular books on the nodes, but it's a bit heavy-handed. And the nodes are rather subtle. The nodes are, they don't physically exist, for example. And they indicate, for example, when the next eclipse is going to happen. So the nodes are talking about a point in space that is activated at a certain time. So they're a cross-dimensional thing between space and a few different ways of looking at time. So they're very subtle. And I think that they're one of the you know, one of the things you should wait the longest to assess in a chart and let the information slowly come out. I mean, one thing about astrology is it comes out in layers. And you don't really ever, you know, get the whole meaning of a chart. I mean, it's another huge, you know, misinterpretation. But if you studied literature and you've studied a Shakespeare sonnet, you can read that Shakespeare sonnet once a month your entire life and get something new out of that sonnet. It's the same words on the page. And the same thing is true with a chart. And the chart changes a little bit more because planets are discovered, but still, every time you come back to that chart, it's going to feel and look and be a little bit different because you're seeing it differently. And I think the nodes are one of the things that give up their secrets last. And, you know, broadly speaking, the anchoring into history of the South Node and the anchoring into the unfamiliar of the North Node, I would say, is approximately true. It's a one way to think of them. But say, for example, in the case of Karen's chart, notice that the nodes are not retrograde. Right? If you scroll down to Karen's chart, you'll see that the nodes' overall movement is retrograde, but a couple of days a week, they're not retrograde. Most people have the nodes with a little retrograde symbol next to them, but a few people, like 20%, don't have that. And that helps influence the meaning of the nodes. And some say it can reverse the meaning of the nodes. And I would say that it just calls for additional balance. And one of the easiest ways to work with the nodes is, for example, both Babe Ruth and Karen have their nodes in Pisces and Virgo. They're always in opposite signs, and at the very least, the nodes tell you about two signs, a polarity in the chart that is one of the more helpful polarities to work with, to balance. Because all of astrology is about balancing polarities to some greater or lesser extent, but the nodes are the only point that always functions absolutely as a polarity. And so they're never separate. So you can work with that. You can work with the aspect between the ruler of the north and the ruler of the south, and you just start to tease it out. And if you're looking at your own chart, look at your transits to these points and see how your life moved and changed and unfolded, where you went, what you let go of as transits happened to the nodes. Really working with astrology this way is an experiential thing. I don't think that the static meaning in books can really get you that far. It's good for commentary. It's good for ideas. It's good, you know, for kind of like a tourist guide. But that's very different than going there. And good tourist guides are amazing. If you're standing on the Acropolis, that tourist guide is great. Saying that is that and that, but it's you're there and you can see things that are not in the tourist guide by going there. So does that help?
Oh, incredibly. Thank you.
Okay. Awesome. Anything else?
Lastly, so if I to look at my node, that's simply, you know, my north node is in Aquarius, and that's my south node being in Leo, my dharma being aligned with Aquarius and north node, thinking that way, is that too simplistic, or is that an idea that I can
It's worth testing. I mean, it's worth checking out. I mean, obviously, with the nodes in Leo and Aquarius, there's going to be some balancing between individuality and group consciousness. And Aquarius has its individualistic side, as we all know, and Leo has its collective side, as we all know. Well, that's subtler. I've seen a very collectivist view of Leos. I think a lot of Leos really are as devoted to the collective as Aquarians are supposed to be. So at the very least, without pigeonholing yourself or anybody else, just look for the theme of that polarity. What's the theme of that polarity? That seems to be an integration of this is me versus this is them. What do I do for myself? What do I do for all of them? Who are these other people? And then look at Saturn as an extension of one node and Sun as an extension of the other node and see what that tells you. See where you're dramatizing that or where it's focused. Right? You know, and you'll start to see, you know, it's interesting, and it can be very subtle with the nodes. I mean, I have the South Node in Capricorn on the seventh house, so I never really understood what that told me, except that I've watched my whole life be the story of unraveling traditional relationship models and finding something else that works for me personally. So that being entwined in traditional models is over, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the ruler is an Aquarius in the ninth house. And so I'm not married, but I'm married to everyone around the world. I organize this worldwide organization of people to whom I have a kind of a marriage-like devotion to them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, you know, there's ways to, you know, you reading biographies and looking at the chart of the person, that can be insightful much more than the biography that you might get on AstroDataBank or Wikipedia. Like, really pick some of your favorite people and look at how their biography tells the story of their chart, not necessarily the other way around.
Okay.
All right.
Great. Thank you very much.
Awesome. I'm sure I'll see you on email, Clarissa.
Yeah,
okay, any other thoughts to share or questions to ask while we are here on this beautiful Saturday morning? Let's take a quick look at the Q&A and see if there's anything I can – okay, here's a good question. I'll close with this. Eric, you have a lot of basic classical astrological knowledge. I believe that a large knowledge base leads to that sixth sense for the nebulous, like playing music. It helps to be trained before one improvises. Do you think we need to get classical astrology education in order to make full use of your intuitive counseling astrology model? Okay, so my model is not that intuitive. I'm really very meticulously looking at the dates of these transits. However, one of the reasons I, right up top, gave you the essential dignities table is that it absolutely helps to know all about how these rulerships work. And you don't memorize this table, you just look things up on it. After a while, you start to memorize it. But term and face, nobody has memorized. Maybe Rob Hand, but I bet he doesn't even have them memorized either. And so you look this up, but rulership and exaltation and detriment and fall, lots of people have that memorized. And so what this is a little map to get yourself around the chart. To, you know, if you don't happen to know that Mercury rules Virgo, then you can look it up on this. And this is really the foundational level. Unfortunately, I can't recommend that many or any really good books. If I stretch, I'll find one. I'll ask David at the Astrology Center what the best books on basic astrology is. At a certain point, I gave up on basic astrology books because they weren't working, and I learned most of what I learned from reading charts and from conversations. I would call the level here that would be good to be on is not exactly classical. It's just your basic grounding in the simple ground rules of baseball. Three strikes, you're out. Four balls is a walk. Swing and a miss, or looking, two different kinds. Your very most basic rules of baseball to know how that works. And you can pick those up by reading planet waves and by talking to other astrologers. Very important that you talk to other astrology students and have a forum to bounce your questions around. And we'll leave this group list open as a space to do that, to bounce those questions around. And I will do my best to find a practical, good book. But by looking at the table of essential dignities, you're going to find out most of what you need to do. And yes, I fully agree that the technique grounding helps bring out that sixth sense thing. And my music teacher agrees, that, you know, you learn your modes, you learn your scales, you learn your keys. I'm very lucky to have taken piano as a kid. And then you improvise. But then I hear music of people who have absolutely no training at all, who are amazing. And I always ask the musicians I like who come through my local rock club, DSP, about their guitar history. And you have guys like Gary Lucas who say they took one lesson and blew it off, and Lou Reed took one lesson and blew it off, and Nels Klein said him and his brother figured it out. Got a lot of ways to do it. Then you have Joe Jackson, who went to conservatory. And I would say they're all approximately equally awesome rock stars. Carole King sat in the Brill Building for God knows how many years with a shitty upright piano and Jerry Goffin pounding out hit songs. A lot of ways to learn music. I do believe that the balancing is good. I did an article about this called The Art and Craft of Astrology, and let me see if I can find that. I'll put it on the resources page. I did this for TMA about the Virgo Pisces axis. Okay, any other thoughts and questions here? Let me just stick that into the I'm going to give this to Chelsea to put into the chat area. So we've got that in immediate gratification style. Okay, so seeing no additional questions I can answer, written or hands up, one last check of hands up. Thank you very much. Email me personally, eric@francis.pw, if you have anything you want to follow up on. I will do a second layer of this class. I suggest if you're curious that you play the recording over. I've been recording on my end so that it sounds a little bit less telephony. It'll sound studio quality on my end, and I'll put this recording up on the chart resources page. Thank you for being part of Planet Waves. Thank you, Chelsea, for doing all the legwork getting this going. And that's all I have to say for now. Have an awesome day and awesome weekend.